Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is best-selling author and Emmy Award-winning musician Karen Henley. Karen and I will be discussing about works of angels in our daily lives and her latest book titled Eye of the Sword, which is book two of the Angelian Circle series. Good morning, Karen. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. I am doing great. Thank you.
Fantastic. Eye of the Sword is an interesting read. It is a wonderful Christian action adventure story, which I like very much. And you have all the angels doing, of course, the angelic stuff, seeking good over evil. So thank you very much for that, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
Wonderful. Let us start by getting to know you a little bit better. Give us a walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Well, I was born and raised in Texas, in West Texas, where there are very few trees. I grew up in a family of readers and was steeped in fairy tales, and I was the first a fan of fairy tales, and then I moved into being a fan of the ancient myths, and I was also raised in a very religious family, so I grew up on Bible stories. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's a lot of angels figure in Bible stories. So I naturally drifted from ancient mythology to the mythology of angels. I grew up in Abilene, as I said, Abilene, Texas, and went to college there. I got a degree in education. I decided to do something that would maybe earn me some money when I got out of college. I was really more interested in art and that kind of creative endeavors, but I got a degree in education with an emphasis in early childhood. And so a lot of the books that I've written in the past are for younger children. I think I like that age because they're curious and they want to know. They're very creative, and that kind of matches my interests. So I did some teaching for a while, moved to Los Angeles after I married a drummer, and he became an audio engineer. For a while we lived in Los Angeles, and that's where I began writing seriously. Our first son was born the same year that my first book was published, so I had two babies in 1 year, and one of them was a book.
Fantastic.
It was pretty interesting. And shortly after that we moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and that's where we have lived ever since. And I began really pressing into the writing and became a public speaker, and have done some entertaining for children. We used to do family concerts. And then in 2002, I went to the Vermont College of Fine Arts to get a master's degree, and got a master's degree in writing for children and young adults. And that's where I began writing novels. So that kind of brings you up to where I am today.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Beautiful story. Going back in time, when did you discover you have a talent for writing?
You know, I think I discovered that in high school. As I told you before, I was interested in art, and I loved to sketch, and I was actually kind of manipulated into a creative writing club so that I could be the illustrator for their annual, they made an annual little booklet for their creative writing. But while I was in that, I also did some writing, and mostly poetry, and that was published in their school literary magazine. So that's kind of where I started out.
Very interesting. Now, if you've written over 100 books or so, of course, with the flavor and angle for children,
right,
what life experiences influence you in your writing?
I would say the first thing that influenced me was actually reading. I loved to read. I would get sucked into books, and I loved to stare at the illustrations and think about the stories. And again, you know, fairy tales were one of the one of the big part of my life. And I was encouraged to do a lot of free play in childhood, so I did a lot of pretending. I also think that I was influenced probably by my parents' hospitality. And I think what's interesting about that is that my parents loved to invite people to our house for dinner. A lot of times we would have relatives over. Sometimes they were friends. And sometimes they were just new people that we met at church. And we would have people over to eat with us and visit with us all the time. And I loved just sitting back and listening to the conversations and watching the people. So I became a people watcher.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also done a lot of traveling. Mm-hmm. And so I think I became a spectator and a listener and an observer in many more ways than I really realized.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I began writing novels, all of those influences about people and their personalities and the way they talk and the settings that I've seen as I've traveled, all of that was stored up in me and came out as I began writing. And, you know, that's one of the wonderful things about writing. It was just it kind of opened a treasure chest for me.
Very interesting. What resonates with me is that when you were talking about how your parents were having people over and you were able to hear the conversations that was going on, because when I was growing up, I had the same thing also. I enjoyed the storytelling among the adults.
Right.
And I would just sit there and listen, and many a times those stories are much better than what's on TV.
Exactly. They're real.
Do you use your writing to express your feelings or just to entertain readers?
Actually, I think I use my writing primarily to entertain readers. Mm-hmm. But what I have discovered is that the best way to entertain readers is to express feelings through your characters. And the best way to express feelings through a character is to express your own feelings. So I come to it through entertaining readers, but the best writing is done when you tap into your own feelings. I think if I simply wanted to express my feelings, I would just write them in a private journal.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to do it through made-up characters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And obviously your background being a teacher and so forth, and in the books of the past that you've written, is
right.
There's a subtlety of a teaching aspects of it as well.
Right, and you know, I think a writer has to be really careful about that, especially a person like me who tends to want to teach, because what a good book does is it does not teach. It's not didactic. It doesn't start out to beat you over the head with some theme.
Right.
What a good book does, it tells you a story, and then out of that story, you learn a theme for yourself.
Very, very interesting approach. And, of course, you being a best-selling author, award-winning author for children's book, now you have crossed over genre to young adults. How did you make that crossover to work?
Well, that is an interesting question, because I do love preschool children so much.
Mm-hmm.
But I had my own children, and they grew up through the teenage years. And, of course, I kind of grew with them. And, you know, if people say, well, why did you cross over from writing for young children because you were so successful there? And, you know, the short answer I think I would give is something that I learned with young children a long time ago, and that is, you know, if you're out for a walk with a young child and you pass a big puddle of water, they'll jump into it. I mean, unless you tell them to stay out, they'll just jump right in. And you say, why did you do that? Well, they really did it because it was there.
Right.
It was there, and they're curious, and they want to know, and they want to find out, they want to be active, and they just jump in. So I guess the short answer is I just jumped in because it was there. But really, writing a novel was the obvious next step for me.
Mm-hmm.
I've always loved reading novels, and the interesting thing is, because I've written a lot for young children, I felt fairly confident in writing. You know, I could write a picture book, I can write an easy reader, I can write activities for children. But even though I was a writer, a novel seemed so daunting to me, because you look at a novel and it's so long, mm-hmm. and how do you sustain a reader's interest from the beginning all the way through to the end? How do you keep a story going that long? And it seemed so magic to me,
mm-hmm.
and I kept thinking, there has to be some magic key to unlock a story that would span hundreds of pages. So as I went to Vermont College and
mm-hmm.
began studying for my master's degree, I really did discover that magic key. And what it is, it's called hard work. With that discovery, finding out that it's just a matter of hard work and getting in there. And mm-hmm. writing a novel is really not writing a novel. It's
mm-hmm.
rewriting a novel. It's revising the novel and working
yeah.
until you tell the story that you really wanted to tell in the first place. So
mm-hmm.
I jumped into the puddle with both feet, and I'm glad I did it.
Fantastic. Did you do a lot of research about angels prior to writing your first novel?
Actually, I did. When I decided that angels were going to be a part of it,
mm-hmm.
I did do a lot of research. I got books about angels and began reading about people's experiences about angels. And it was amazing, this whole world of angelology,
mm-hmm.
Study of angels, that I didn't really know existed. I'm most familiar with the angels in the Bible, but
right.
I didn't know that so much has been imagined and created about angels since that time. So it was very interesting.
It covers all cultures, basically, because everyone has their own angel, except it's called different names.
Right.
Can you enlighten us with some of the things that you have found out?
Right. If you're talking about angels through culture,
mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, in Islam, there mm-hmm. are angels. They have shining bodies made of light, and they have two or three or four or even sometimes they're described with even more wings.
Mm-hmm.
And it's said that each believer is accompanied by two angels, one on the right, one on the left.
Mm-hmm.
And those are types of guardian angels, although they also keep records that pertain to the individual they're assigned to. So in Islam, there are angels like that. Even in, if you talk about Hinduism,
mm-hmm.
There are the devas, which are not really angels, but they do function as types of angels. And I'm talking about angels really in the sense of an intermediary between
mm-hmm.
humans and the heavens, or humans and God. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, even in the Sanskrit, there are
right.
Divine spirits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So really, you're right. In all cultures, you see these figures, and often they have wings.
Mm-hmm. And the fascinating thing about it also is that there are a lot of commonalities that you find in all these angels,
mm-hmm.
because they are messengers of God,
exactly.
and they're here to protect us and guide us to make sure that we do the right thing, so to speak. But having said that, of course, we all have free will. That's what God has given us. So
right. right.
And that gets us into trouble sometimes, but
that's
it's
right.
quite interesting.
That's right.
Can you tell us the hierarchies of the different angels?
Well, you know, what's interesting about the hierarchies, they're often ranked. Now,
mm-hmm.
the Bible does not rank hierarchies, but a
mm-hmm.
lot of people have put them in ranks.
Mm-hmm.
And usually there's 7 to 10 listed in the rankings.
Mm-hmm.
And they're called orders. Sometimes they're called orders. And the highest orders usually are... common between most of these hierarchies, the highest order are cherubim and seraphim, and there's another order called in many times the ophanim, or they may be called thrones. There are lots of different names for these types of angels. But
mm-hmm.
that's the highest sphere generally, and the highest sphere do not normally interact with humans.
Mm-hmm.
They are around God's throne, and that's where they stay. And different people who have come up with different hierarchies describe their jobs in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's a second sphere, a middle sphere, and they're like heavenly governors.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're called dominions or lordships, principalities, rulers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're more like governors, but they do interact as well with humans. They regulate duties of the lower angels, or they preside over nations. Some of them seem to be living symbols of God's justice. And they're all very humble beings. You know, they are willing to serve God without being seen and known and worshipped by humans. And then there's the lower sphere, and those would be again, they have different names depending on what hierarchy you read. But there are the powers and the archangels, and then just the regular angels. Basically, angel means messenger.
Mm-hmm.
So all these lower orders of angels are there not only to guard us, but to guide us and bring us the messages of, basically, of God's love and encouragement to us, but also of wisdom, I think.
Interesting. Do you believe in angels?
I do. I believe that there are angels. I believe there's an entire spiritual realm that lies just beyond us, just beyond our seeing and hearing, and maybe even parallel to our human realm.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe angels are part of that realm. After having said that, I have to admit that the angels in my books, in my novels, are really pure fantasy. I based my angel hierarchy, and in the front of my book, I do have a hierarchy listed out, the ranks of angels. And I based it loosely on the spheres of angels that St. Thomas Aquinas describes.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I can tell, after all my research, because there are so many names for angels, people are thinking of where they might be in charge, what they might be in charge of, and what they might do. As far as I can tell, nobody really knows about the ranks of angels, not even Thomas Aquinas. So the angels that I have invented are based on my speculation that real angels, and here's what I believe, that real angels are emanations of light, which travels too fast to be visible, and yet it surrounds all of us. That idea is not unique to me, but it makes sense to me that in order to be seen, an angel would have to slow down to our speed. And I just find that a very fascinating subject to explore.
Very interesting. Well, there's a sort of resurgence of the need of wanting to know about angels.
Yeah.
In the newer generations, because there is a generation long time ago that tend to be religious and whatnot and so forth, that if you're religious, then you are really obviously focused on angels, the things that you were taught in from a religious perspective. And then everyone kind of got away from it. And then now, in some ways, being religious and being spiritual, even though it's not quite the same, but everyone believes in angels, that there's someone out there that's guiding you to do the right thing. Or helping you to do the right thing.
Right.
So that's very interesting. What do you think that causes people to have this sort of resurgence of wanting to believe that there are angels out there to help them?
Well, I believe that there's always been some people who have never let go of that belief. So it has been with us and around us for a long time. But I do think that you're right. There was a time when we decided, basically, as humans, that we were going to find all the answers for ourselves, and we began researching, and there's nothing wrong with research, and I'm not against science at all. I think the fact that there is science proves that there are things that we don't know, because a scientist actually bases his entire career and everything he goes for mm-hmm. on the premise that he wants to discover what it is that he doesn't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's all science is discovering what we don't know and we really believe is out there, whether it's a cure for cancer or whether it's black holes or something in the cosmos. All scientists and researchers direct their energy toward discovering what we don't know. So all of us humans know that there is a realm that we don't know, and some mm-hmm. of us, when we really put our faith in rational science and in mm-hmm. discoveries and in we can make the world, we can put the world on the right track. And for I guess hundreds of years since the age of reason began, we mm-hmm. really moved toward progress, and we thought progress was going to answer all our questions. It was going to heal all our diseases. It was going to show us a better world. Well, in a sense, we do have a better world. We have a lot of things that are helping us out in medicine and technology. However, when you look at humanity, we have no better world now than we did back in ancient times. We're still fighting each other. We're still hating. We're still taking vengeance. We're still reaching for power, mm-hmm. you know, greed, all of those kinds of things have not changed in the human heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there came a time, and I think researchers who study the ages would probably say this is where modernity changed to mm-hmm. becoming post-modernity, and that was somewhere in the 1960s and so on. But from the middle of the 20th century on to today, there's been a backlash mm-hmm. against all of that progressive, those progressive goals that we thought, you know, we can make ourselves better. Mm-hmm. And we've realized that, you know, research and science, it has made our lives better. But on the other hand, we may not have done ourselves a favor to ingest all these chemicals that we invented to make our lives better, you know.
Right.
So we're deciding that, you know what, the utopia was not there.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going back, I think, to reaching for, again, the unknown, the spiritual, those things that can, no matter what is happening in the world, whether the world is in 21st century technology or whether it was back in the Middle Ages, there has always been a place within each individual
mm-hmm.
where we could find peace, where we could find the love and the joy, and it gets right back into what is inside us, not what is out in the world that we create among ourselves.
But very true. Very true.
We're starting to look again mm-hmm. for our answers in the spiritual.
Very true. Because when it's all said and done, we're governed by two equal but separate forces, love and fear, that has always been with us since the beginning of time till today. And
right.
What I like about it that you are able to use the same concept to apply it to your book and sort of, in a very soft way, teach the young adults, the teens, about looking further beyond what's visible and looking into themselves from within, from the
right.
stories that you tell in your book. So that's very, very interesting. You introduce the readers to the young priestess Malaya in Breath of Angel.
Right.
And now you got someone else involved with the situation in Eye of the Sword. So tell us a little bit about Eye of the Sword. What is it all about?
Well, Eye of the Sword is about a young man named Trevin who is of low rank, and he is on a quest to prove his loyalty to the king and to prove his love for the princess. And the princess happens to be the same girl who was the priestess in Book One.
Mm-hmm.
She was the hero in Book One. He is coming in Book Two, and Book Two is written from his point of view. But on his journey to prove his loyalty to the king and his love for the princess, He is challenged by angels. He confronts false accusations, treachery, murder, but he discovers that his most difficult challenge is facing himself and facing the shame and the pain and the terror of his own past. Eye of the Sword is very much about identity. It's about facing yourself and being honest with yourself. It's about finding your strengths and acknowledging your strengths, but also finding and acknowledging your weaknesses and then finding a way forward from there. So those are kind of the things that he discovers on his journey.
It's a wonderfully written book, even though this is high fantasy, backdrop medieval times.
Right.
I think we can relate right now that it's in existence in our daily life.
Right. I think that with any time you read a novel that is written historically, if it's a good novel, the truth that you identify with, even if it's a fantasy, it may not be real. The events may not be real. And even the characters may be a little strange, like angels.
Mm-hmm.
However, what is real and what is true about the story is the human emotion, the human element involved. And as long as we have those human elements involved, then I believe the reader can identify with whatever character it is, as long as we deal with those human emotions. That's key.
Very interesting. Did you come up with the image of Trevin for the cover of the book?
For the cover of the book, the actual image, I did not. The cover designer did that.
Mm-hmm.
It's very unusual for a publisher to allow an author to have any kind of say in what the cover is going to look like. They have experts at the publishing company who are experts in making their decisions about that. They were very, very good to me to send me a picture, well, actually send me several pictures of what they thought Trevin might look like.
Mm-hmm.
And I chose one and said, this is what I have in mind. And actually, it was not the picture they used, but I pictured him a little bit more rugged and a little older, but I am not disappointed. Everybody who looks at the cover of Eye of the Sword,
right.
They say, wow, this guy is a good-looking guy. So after my publisher sent me the mock-up of the cover, I said, yeah, that'll work. That'll work for me. So I loaded it onto my computer, and every time I would do my revisions of my manuscript, I would put, put the cover, the picture on my computer so that I could look at it, and it really helped me to hear his voice. I already usually hear the voice of my characters, but looking at him, I could see it a little bit better. So, but he works. The guy works, so this is good.
Well, you just mentioned something very important, because that is how creativity works together. Because having the picture in mind, and now you have something right in front of the cover, that gives you the freedom, basically the opportunity to really get into that person's character. And that makes a big difference.
It does. And, that is one technique that some authors use. They will find, they'll just go through magazines and find pictures of people that they think, not all authors do this, but some of them do. And it helps them focus. It helps them to hear a voice. It helps them to see a person. And I do like to write by visualizing. It's almost like I see a movie in my head, and I'm taking dictation. I'm writing down what the characters are doing and saying, and if it doesn't fit, I go back and say, okay, we're going to do this different. We're going to do this different next time. So I'm still in charge, but I like to see it as a movie.
Interesting. Was it difficult to write the story from a male perspective?
Actually, it wasn't. It was a lot of fun. As I said, with all my characters, it helps if I can see them in my mind's eye and hear their voice. And once I hear a voice, I can begin writing the scene in earnest. And really, for Trevin, because he was a male character, I was able to, I've raised two sons through through teens, and I've got a husband. I'm really the only woman in the household. So coming from, you know, thinking about how would a male react, you know, that wasn't really too hard for me to think. Now, of course, a man might read the book and say, oh, this is really off base. But my husband read it and said, and he liked it. So maybe I didn't get too too far-fetched with it. But, you know, I did read some books that talked about men, and I know that guys, when they talk, they tend to use more active words. They tend to use fewer adjectives, and they tend to be sharp and short when they talk. Now, that's just a tendency. That's, you know, not all guys are that way. But even when I started writing, trying to think of, you know, okay, how would a guy see this, I also needed to make sure that I didn't stereotype him. You know, it's very easy for us to stereotype a person from the other gender, and so I tried to make him individual as well, because all of us as humans face situations in our own unique ways. And so many of the issues that Trevin deals with are universal, but he looks at them with a male point of view as well as with what I would call a Trevin point of view, because he has his own issues to deal with as well. So, you know, I just, it was fun. It was a lot of fun to think of a guy's perspective.
What would you like for your readers to gain from reading Eye of the Sword?
Well, my theory about well-written novels is that readers find in them what the reader is ready to see. And as I said earlier, I really primarily write to entertain, but several themes have emerged from the story that I'm telling, and one of them is courage versus fear. We were talking about fear a minute ago.
Right.
Another one is image versus character. And not character in the sense of protagonist-antagonist, but character in the sense of the inner values that you hold. Love and loss, or vengeance versus forgiveness, or again, facing yourself. So really I think that each person will probably see, even, you know, people may see themes that I didn't even know I wrote. But I think that facing yourself may be the main topic of exploration in Eye of the Sword for me, facing up to your past and forgiving yourself. Sometimes it's harder to forgive yourself than it is to forgive other people, and then living life forward from that point. So I really want all the books that I write, whether they're novels or not, to have a message of hope in them. So facing life and living life forward, I think that's one of the main main topics that I would like for people to understand from the book. Yeah.
Very interesting. One of the things that I got from your book is that the fact that you do address issues that are pretty much age-old issues that's still happening today. For example, it would be like human trafficking. Of course, we talk about children trafficking, those kind of things. And I think when you address those issues in books like yours, that helps to bring it to the forefront in some ways to kind of keep it current.
I agree. I agree. Like I said, that, you know, we really, as human beings, we haven't changed all that much, which is kind of a shame. but it does allow us to go ahead and talk about those issues that have been around since forever, but that we still need to look at. We don't need to sweep them under the rug. We need to bring them out in the open and look at them.
That's very true. And also, of course, besides being an action-adventure book, it is about love and romance. So what was your favorite scene to write in this book?
Well, actually, the sword fights were my favorite scenes.
Okay.
I bought a good book on sword fighting, and I tried to make each scene as realistic as I could, and I really enjoyed challenging Trevin by giving him a female sword fighting instructor. In fact, she's an angel, and I especially like the scene in which this instructor, this warrior angel, coaches Trevin on his technique. He did not ask for the coaching, but her advice is exactly right. And after he wrestles with his pride and he finally swallows it, they actually become good friends, and he becomes a very good sword fighter.
That's part of the process of, again, of humbling oneself.
Yes. And she actually becomes kind of a guardian angel for him.
Coming back to talking about angels and so forth, have you experienced an angelic moment for yourself?
Well, actually, I have. I feel closer and more familiar with God himself. Angels, to me, are beings who operate separate and apart from me. And God, actually, I believe, operates within me and can indwell me through his spirit, I think. And I call God's spirit my Godmother. That's part of the function of God's spirit, my Godmother, to enter and indwell me and to impart life and hope and love and wisdom. But that said, actually, I do live with an almost constant sense of the divine presence, and I say presence with a capital P. And several specific instances stand out. I once had the sense of a presence at my bedside, and I just knew in my heart that that presence was an angel, and I immediately just knew what she looked like and what her name was. And that was, you know, it was a time of peace and a time of comfort and a time of courage. I've also heard a song that seems to be specifically for me, and I don't know if it was angels singing it or actually God singing it. But I remember it, and sometimes when it's hard for me to go to sleep at night, I remind myself of that song, and I let that song sing me to sleep. I've heard an inner voice when I have been wondering and asking questions. And the reason I know it was not my conscience or my voice is because I was asking God, how long, Lord, and it was in connection with my life and the direction that I'm going, how long till I know this direction, how long till I get there? And the interesting thing was that what I heard was WG, which is very strange. I didn't know what it meant. And that's how I know that I didn't tell myself that. It was WG. And so I said, I just asked, I said, WG, what is that?
Right.
And here was the answer. Worship God with gladness, wait graciously, we'll get there. Every one of those phrases.
Wow.
WG, WG, WG.
Right.
And you know what I gained from that, besides just the encouragement that we're not alone in our journey, what I also gained was, you know, how gracious was that I am a person who loves to work with words. I love word puzzles. I love, of course, I love writing, which is like working a word puzzle. And when that voice talked to me, it gave me a word puzzle, just exactly individualized for me. So, you know, I can't tell anyone else how God will work with them or how their angels will speak to them or influence them or anything else. But what I can tell you is that it will be specifically tailored for you as an individual. It will be for your courage and for your direction and your well-being. That just is, it amazes me, the love that is there, and the grace and the beauty to be so individualized.
Very interesting story. And the other thing as well, too, is that people sometimes look at it, well, I have to have this sort of an aberration of a godlike aberration out there to really
right.
connect with an angel. But they sometimes tend to forget that some angels, and I use this word loosely in the sense that
mm-hmm.
because they're angels walking among us
right.
as human beings that were there at the right moment, the right time when we need something.
Exactly, exactly. I do believe that God sends his messengers and his guardians to people who aren't even maybe at that point even looking for him or who may even be denying him
mm-hmm.
at that point. But, you know, they're still there. That's God's love. That's the bigness and the wide fullness of who he is, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And for us to be able to tune into that is basically being in the present moment, because if you allow yourself to be in the present moment, the answers are actually all around you, because
yes.
from the people, it's the concept of if you're thinking that you're going to have this white light that hits you and so forth and all that, and maybe very well that may be.
Right.
But on the other hand, don't count out that someone, whether it's your friend or a total stranger that may be coming your way, God sent,
right.
so to speak,
right.
to
exactly.
help you, and don't count that out.
Right. Exactly. I do believe that. I think that they are there for guiding and helping everyone. Mm-hmm.
With just one more book in the trilogy to go, can you give us a sneak peek of what to expect?
Oh, okay. Well, I actually have already written the third book, so I know how the story goes. Book one came from the point of view of Malaya, the young priestess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Book two came from the point of view of Trevin. Book three is going to alternate between
mm-hmm.
their points of view. It's going to take both of them. And if you've read the first couple of books, you know that there is a window of time in which they have to work to restore the stairway to heaven, which was destroyed by some immortals who are now in basically warring against each other and feuding.
Mm-hmm.
And as this window of time for restoring the stairway narrows, Trevin insists that he and not Malaya will retrieve the third harp from this evil land called the Dregmores. Now, he does that simply to protect her. He
mm-hmm.
loves her. He does not want her to have to face the villain. But Malaya has her own plans, as does another angel who will put all of their efforts in danger. So Trevin and Malaya have to trust their love to hold when good appears evil, evil lurks in the disguise of good, and yeah, we'll see where it takes them. I won't tell you the end.
That sounds wonderful. That sounds
yeah.
to me like communication now.
Yeah, yeah.
Wonderful. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, to learn more about me and my books, you could go to breathofangel.com. That's the title of the first book, Breath of Angel. And you can read all about me and my books there. I'm also on Facebook. I have an author page on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Goodreads. And to buy my books, they should be available wherever Random House books are sold. That's what
mm-hmm.
I've been told, which means that you can find them, you should be able to find them or order them through your independent bookstore or Barnes & Noble or Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also on Kindle and Nook. They're as e-books. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, they're available just about everywhere.
Fantastic. As an accomplished veteran author, what three things can you suggest to new writers to fine-tune their craft?
Well, the first thing that I would suggest to new writers is read and read and read some more. Read in all genres. Writers tend to write best what they
mm-hmm.
enjoy reading best.
Mm-hmm.
But reading through all types of genres will inform you, and it will just be fuel for your fire. The second pointer I would say is to write and write and write some more. To
mm-hmm.
practice your craft and to exercise your art, and if you need to learn more about it, go to classes, get books. There are plenty of books that help help beginning writers learn how to write. And then the third point I would say is to, if you are a serious writer, then get your first draft written. A lot of people will start on a book, but they never finish it through because they're always reworking the first chapter or they get discouraged. And I just say, you know, write your first draft. No writer's first draft is ever publishable.
Mm-hmm.
So write your first draft, get feedback from good readers whom you trust to be honest with you. That may not be your mom. she may love whatever you write. But don't be afraid of getting critique, and don't be afraid to rewrite until you've told the story that you really want to tell the best way you can tell it.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Besides being a writer, you are also a speaker as well, and one of the topics you address is communicating with children and teens. Is there any suggestions you could give us regarding this?
I think my big suggestion would be listen.
Mm-hmm.
Most often when we think communicate, we think talk.
Mm-hmm.
But the flip side of that coin is listen, and we don't do enough listening. When we listen respectfully to our kids and consider what the child or the teen is saying and keep our mouths shut for a while, then if we truly listen, we gain a better understanding of where the child is coming from, where the teen is coming from. And sometimes all they need is for us to listen to them as they talk, and they sort out the issues themselves.
Mm-hmm.
If we really do need to speak into the issue or into what the teen is concerned about, then when we do speak, if we have listened first, they are more likely to listen to us because we've earned their respect by respectfully listening to them.
And what you're saying also is that you got to be in the present moment to be able to listen.
Absolutely.
Successfully.
Yes. You don't think about, okay, what am I going to say? If we're thinking about how we're going to, what we're going to come back with,
right,
then we're not really listening to what they're saying. We're thinking about what we're going to say.
Right. Those are some basic skills, ironically, in life that, you know, when we were kids, we are like that. We are always in the present moment.
Right.
And as we get old, that somehow tend to kind of get away from us.
Right. And you know what? About the present moment, that's where the peace is.
Mm-hmm.
When you're worried about the past or you're thinking over the past, what you did do or what you didn't do, you're not in a peaceful place. If you're thinking about the future, what you should do, what you need to do, what's coming up, a lot of times that's a place of anxiety because we don't know what's coming ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So looking ahead can produce anxiety. Looking at the past can produce anxiety. Right now, right here and right now, being, as you said, in the present moment, that's where the peace is. Usually, if we'll stop and take a breath, maybe just a two-minute break, look mm-hmm. around us, breathe, and relax, most present moments are not anxious moments. Now, sometimes there's a danger, sometimes there's an accident or something, and we have to be present in a way, but then we have to be present in a way that we don't panic.
Right.
Being most present moments are moments of peace if we will only stop and mm-hmm. relax in it.
Do you do plenty of listening to teens before you write your first book in the genre?
Not specifically.
Mm-hmm.
I know I have listened to teens, and of course I listened to my own sons growing up, and mm-hmm. I've worked with teens in classroom situations,
mm-hmm.
and I know that developmentally a teen is forming his or her own identity
mm-hmm.
As a person separate from mom and dad, and I also know that one of their greatest desires is to be wanted and accepted, to be loved and respected, and of course that's what we all want.
Mm-hmm.
So the teen I really listened to was my own teen self because I remember what it was like.
Right.
So I tried to write the book that I wanted to read. And, of course, that's good advice for any author. Write the book you want to read.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. We're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Actually, yes, I do, and it really is a culmination of what we've been talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
And I have this written down and taped to my desk. Before I tell you, I'll just say I believe that our lives are stories. Your life is a story. My life is a story. We are writing our own stories by the choices that we make each day. And so my recipe for living, it's something that I wrote out one day last year, and I taped it to my desk, and
mm-hmm.
here's what it says. I will live life forward in gratitude and hope, knowing love always wins. And that's my
beautiful.
Recipe.
That's beautiful.
That's my recipe. Mm-hmm.
And has that helped you, I presume, throughout your life?
It has helped me. I had to grow into it. I had to
mm-hmm.
realize what my life recipe was, and it took some stumbling around to get there. But that's what it is, and that's what I think it will be from here on out.
That's wonderful. That's a beautiful recipe for living. Any final thoughts about Eye of the Sword?
Well, my thought really circles around to something you said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
These days, there are a lot of novels about fallen angels versus good angels battling it out over a soul, and
mm-hmm.
most of them are written in the contemporary world.
Yeah.
And I really hope that Eye of the Sword will stand out as something fresh and deep and different with its ancient world and its classic tale of hope and love. And Elizabeth George, who is a mystery writer, said that she just hopes that her books will be worthy of readership. And really, that's my hope, too. I hope my books, my novels, will be worthy of readership. I don't want to waste your time. I hope that when you read it, you'll benefit from it.
I do. So I'm sure whoever
Good.
Read it will always get something out of it. When we put ourselves in the various characters in the book,
yes,
then you will understand and experience that appropriately.
Good. I think so.
So that makes a big difference. As a last question, how has writing the series impacted you personally, being that this is quite a different genre and so forth, and you are really exploring the realm of angels and so forth?
Well, writing the series has given me a deep sense of satisfaction and joy. It's helped me clarify some of the basic beliefs of my own.
Mm-hmm.
And as for the actual writing process, I learned to trust the process. So many times I would reach a point at which I could not see how to move forward, but somehow the muse part of my mind would come up with the answer. The answer doesn't necessarily come immediately, but Madeleine L'Engle, a famous writer, said that inspiration comes during work. So I keep working, and many times the answer will pop into my mind. You know, it occurs to me that really this is another life lesson. When you reach a point where you can't see how to move forward, you just keep taking the next step, and you keep working, and the answer will come. It will be there. So, that's what I learned. I learned not to worry myself into knots.
Mm-hmm.
About where the answer is, because
mm-hmm.
it will come.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. So you're basically saying follow your heart and just continue.
Just continue. Trust the process. There is a process. Trust that you're not alone in the journey, and you're moving forward.
And then, of course, pray a whole lot.
and pray. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
Nothing wrong at all. Yeah.
Very interesting. Very, very interesting. Karen, thank you for the great recipe for living you have shared with us earlier and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us this morning. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be New York Times best-selling author Susan Mallory. Susan and I will be discussing about her latest novel titled Barefoot Season. It is about the life of Michelle, an Army veteran, returning home after tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, only to find out everything has changed. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Karen, thank you again, and have a great day.
Thank you. It was delightful.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.